From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It may feel more like Groundhog Day, but tomorrow is Election Day for runoff races in Georgia. Voters will choose a Secretary of State and who will fill the remaining open seat for the Public Service Commission for District 3. Bill Nigut is host of Political Rewind, and he's here with me as the very end of a long election season comes to a close. Hello, Bill.
How are you, Virginia?
Great. I'm glad to have you with us. And I want to start with this runoff for Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Questions over the integrity of elections, oversight got a lot of attention, accusations of voter suppression, with now Governor-elect Brian Kemp having held that office. What can you tell us about Brad Raffensperger, the Republican candidate who wants to replace him?
Brad Raffensperger has been a member of the House. He's obviously the more conservative of the two candidates, the other one being John Barrow, who was a Democratic member of the U.S. House for a number of terms. Raffensperger has so far essentially said that he believes that the election apparatus, everything from registration to the machines that are used in terms of how many are put into place, all the other apparatus, absentee ballots, provisional ballots, should be in the hands of the counties, who in fact do control our elections, 159 counties in Georgia. And the one thing Raffensperger does say is that he believes that the Secretary of State has an obligation to try to have more uniform rules and regulations so that the counties are doing things the same way. And one of the reasons that's kind of interesting is, as you just said, there's been so much controversy and continues to be controversy over how Georgia ran its election. And most of it focused, of course, on Brian Kemp's office, because he was Secretary of State and he didn't step down during the campaign. But the reality is that elections are run by the counties with oversight from the Secretary of State's office. And that's how Raffensperger wants to continue things, with some additional state oversight.
Well, a federal judge ultimately decided there would not be enough time for the state to implement paper ballots in advance of the election. But the state's touchscreen voting machines are out of date. No paper backup, and a number of IT professionals weighed in that the system is not secure. Has Raffensperger talked about that specifically?
Yeah. Well, remember, there is a commission that was impaneled last year by Secretary of State Brian Kemp to look at alternatives that to the voting machines we now use. Voting machines, most specifically, the concern has been that don't produce a paper trail of any sort. As you know, as a new Georgia voter,
right,
you go in and you touch the screen, and at the end of the voting, you get to go back and review who you voted for on the screen, but you can't be certain that your vote is counted correctly. So there is a belief pretty broad, widely spread by both Republicans and Democrats, that at the very least we need machines that produce some sort of paper trail. There is a group looking at that right now. They're looking at various machines that accomplish the purpose of electronic voting, perhaps, as well as the paper trail. And they'll make recommendations to the Secretary of State and ultimately to the legislature, we imagine, in this upcoming session to acquire new voting machinery. But there's a difference between the two candidates in this. Raffensperger wants electronic voting with a paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrat, John Barrow, says we really ought to have paper ballots. We ought to go back to a system in which we punched, perhaps, the name of the candidate that we were voting for, and he believes that those ballots should then be read by an optical scanner to produce the result. Barrow's concern is he believes that electronic voting is subject to hacking.
Right. And how else is the Democrat, John Barrow, distinguishing himself in his candidacy?
He believes the Secretary of State's office should exercise far more control of the elections in all 159 counties, should insist on uniform procedures for handling absentee ballots, provisional ballots, how those ballots are counted. He is much more likely, if he becomes Secretary of State, to put this the office in a far more rigid control of how elections are run by those 159 separate counties.
Well, obviously, the election between them was close. How close are they looking in the runoffs? What's the word in the polling?
It's really hard to tell. As of the end of last week, we've been looking at early voting. That voting period was short. It started last Monday and ran through Friday. And as we looked at the demographics, which is all we get to see in early voting, voters who have turned out are all older, they are whiter, and the speculation is, based on a lot of experience over the years from many observers, that it is likely that those are people who are more inclined to vote Republican than Democratic. We don't know. We'll have to wait and see tomorrow what the turnout is among voters who tend demographically to vote more for Democrats. But a lot of the experts in this field seem to think the data suggests that Georgia is so far leaning towards Republicans in the Secretary of State's race as well as the PSC race.
Right. The mail-in ballots received far behind those in the general election.
Well, and in fact, they've been extended. Now the deadline has been extended because absentee ballots weren't set out in enough time for people to vote and get them back. Do you want to know about I'm looking up as of the end of Friday what the demographics
are.
So right now, as of the end of the vote on Friday, the early voting, 69% of the voters were white, 23% were African American, and in terms of age, it's really interesting. Between 50 and 65 and over, those voters represent 86% of the people who have turned out. Very, very few. 2.5%, 18 to 29, 4%, 30 to 39. I mean, the fact of the matter is these are numbers that Republicans are happy to see.
Well, in her not-quite-concession speech, Stacey Abrams, Democratic candidate for governor, told supporters to go out and vote for John Barrow in the runoff. Doesn't sound like she succeeded in getting the turnout.
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, remember, Election Day is tomorrow, and there is voting apparatus out there. I do think there are people, as you say, who have kind of looked at where Abrams and her machinery have focused in the aftermath of her loss. They have obviously spent an enormous amount of time on preparing the federal lawsuit, which has now been filed, in which they are challenging much of the way in which Georgia runs its elections. And there are people who worry that perhaps she hasn't focused as much as they'd like her to on helping turn out the vote for the Democrats on the runoff ballot. Although I was talking to people this weekend who say they've kind of had touches from the Abrams folks. They've gotten things in the mail saying, get out and cast your vote for John Barrow. So while the early vote seems to be favoring Republicans, let's see what happens when the polls actually open on Election Day tomorrow.
Well, one last question on that race. When the Atlanta Press Club hosted a runoff debate here at GPB last week, Raffensperger did not show, leaving Barrow alone to answer panelists' questions. So first, what happened?
It depends on who you talk to.
Okay, how about the Raffensperger campaign?
The Raffensperger campaign contends that the invitation from the Atlanta Press Club, which is really the organization that produces the debates, we
just host them here.
On our air, but it's the Press Club. The Raffensperger campaign contends that the invitation from the Press Club to debate on that date went to an intern on their campaign, and that the information was never forwarded to senior staff. Therefore, Raffensperger was out doing other things, didn't want to change his schedule. That's what they say. Now, there's also reason to think that the Raffensperger people were fairly confident that they could pull off this victory and didn't see any advantage to being involved in a debate. We don't know what to make of all this, but it does seem odd that somehow an invitation to a debate would not get to the people who make those decisions.
An intern gets blamed again. Runoff elections for Secretary of State and Public Service Commission are tomorrow. I'm speaking with GPB's Bill Nigut about the races. And let's get to that Public Service Commission race. Not generally a barn burner of a contest, but a lot of attention about it this time. Remind us of what the Public Service Commission really does.
Well, I mean, the Public Service Commission, first of all, I think it is a barn burner of a contest, Virginia.
I mean, not generally, I said.
No, no, I think, okay, good. Yeah, see, that's exactly right. Typically, we never pay attention to races that are that far down the ballot, or we rarely do, is a better way to say it. This time, it's a significant contest because the Public Service Commission is the body that is tasked with regulating and overseeing public utilities in the state. Here's a piece of trivia for you. Georgia was one of the first states to impanel a version of the Public Service Commission. They brought together a group in the late 1800s, I think 1870-something, to oversee and regulate the railroads.
Huh.
And that has morphed over all these decades into the Public Service Commission, which does, in fact, look at utility rates, at requests for rate hikes, at requests for capital projects surrounding the various utilities. And that's why this time the PSC race is suddenly more important. And I'll bet you're going to talk about
Well,
Plant
you've got
Vogel.
An incumbent, Chuck Eaton, a Republican, faces Democratic candidate Lindy Miller. But the PUC, lots and lots of outside money have been aiming to influence this election, especially $750,000-plus funded by a nuclear power industry group in support of the incumbent, Chuck Eaton. Give us the lay of the land on what is going on with Plant Vogel and his relationship. This is twin nuclear reactors being built in Waynesboro, years behind schedule, billions of dollars over budget. But enough interest for folks to take down an incumbent, do you think?
Well, we'll find out tomorrow, won't we? Yeah, Plant Vogel has been controversial. The addition of the two new towers at Plant Vogel has become enormously controversial, and they're the reasons that suddenly the PSC race has more interest than it typically would have. As you point out, they are years and years behind schedule on completion of the project. There are those who think that they may never really be able to complete it, although that's unlikely. They will find a way to do it. The real question here is, in terms of Eaton and Lindy Miller, is who pays for all these overruns? Lindy Miller says, consumers, we've already been paying for the construction as it has unfolded over the years already. You pay extra on your Georgia power bill. I do, too, for the construction. Lindy Miller is saying, no more.
Hmm.
I hold the line. The Public Service Commission should not allow that money to continue to come out of the pockets of consumers. Eaton says eventually customers, in all fairness, are going to have to be charged somewhat higher rates, small rate hikes, but rate hikes to pay for the towers.
Well, Bill, thanks for the rundown. I know we have just 30 seconds left, but you are going to be talking today on Political Rewind about President
George Herbert Walker Bush.
Who you covered for years.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with President Bush, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation. Senator Johnny Isaacson will be with us, along with others who have known him over the years, and it should be, I hope, a really wonderful conversation.
Bill Nigut, thanks so much. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia has finally caught up on processing a backlog of sexual assault kits. These so-called rape kits preserve evidence that can be critical to prosecuting rapists. In 2016, the Georgia legislature passed a bill requiring faster submission of kits to the state crime lab. That law followed the discovery of more than 1,300 untested kits at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta and subsequent revelations of nearly 10,000 untested kits statewide. The Georgia Bureau of Investigations finished testing those kits last month. Ann Burgess is president of End Violence Against Women International, and she met with GBI to advise them on presenting new evidence to rape survivors. Ann, welcome.
Thank you.
So why was there such a substantial backlog in Georgia?
Well, I think what we experienced with the backlog in Georgia was not too unlike with what we found out throughout the country on the issue of rape kit backlogs. In 2015, USA Today conducted a nationwide audit through FOIA requests. And that really was the impetus to each of the states kind of drilling down once real tragedies were identified, such as Detroit and with Cleveland. Most of the other states identified that we each had a problem. You know, it stems from a systemic change. Interestingly enough, DNA is not that old. We actually started implementing it. We're part of CODIS in the late 90s. And the science and the technology has advanced so quickly that sadly, protocols and policies with regards to how we manage kits, how we stored kits from a law enforcement perspective, didn't keep pace. And sadly, this was the revelation and the outcome.
On that policy front, what exactly did the legislature here in Georgia mandate?
In 2016, the legislation here in Georgia mandated, that we first be accountable and complete an audit that gave us the facts about what we were looking at with rape kits. B, it next put into place accountability with timing and transfer and management of those kits, that from the time a kit was collected, it would be transferred to law enforcement within 96 hours. And from the time law enforcement agency took possession, it would go to the crime lab within 30 days. That was the first tangible step in accountability and timeline management to assure that kits were not placed into storage and lost in the shuffle.
Well, there are about 9,000 kits yet to be processed in January of last year. Any news on what has been discovered and in terms of people of interest or resulting arrests or prosecutions?
Yes, actually, they've got some. They have completed testing. My numbers are a little bit different than yours, but they've completed testing on 3,005 kits. They've yielded about 321 DNA profiles. They've identified at least two serial rapists that are offenders attached to multiple cases. It's resulted in a number of arrests. There's over 100 active investigations. And additionally, my understanding is there's about 24 or 25 pending arrests to be completed. So one of the very tangible outcomes was the creation as well of a statewide expert committee that is overseen by the Office of the Governor's Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, which convenes and strengthens collaboration and communication between allied partner agencies, all dedicated to working on this, law enforcement, medical, prosecution, the courts. Representative Scott Holcomb, who actually dropped the 2016 legislation, is also involved with that. And additionally, there's a task force, Metro Atlanta Sexual Assault Cold Case Task Force, was implemented as a result, which has also strengthened and united a law enforcement response to assuring this doesn't happen again, and yet utilizing resources on the investigation of these backlogged kits that are now being analyzed and investigations being forwarded.
Well, Ann Burgess, president of End Violence Against Women International, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ann met with the GBI as it finally caught up on testing the state's backlog of rape kits. And these issues with rape kits go far beyond Georgia. Ashley Fonts is an investigative reporter with CNN. She's with us in the studio. Ashley, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Mark Greenblatt, he is with ProPublica. Both have reported on rape victims' struggles to find justice. And welcome to you, Mark.
Good to be with you. I'm with Newsy, and we worked with ProPublica and Reveal on this story.
Well, thank you for that. Ashley, wanted to start with you. In 2016, a CNN team began surveying local law enforcement agencies across the nation about whether they had actually destroyed sexual assault kits. What did that investigation reveal?
Yeah, so we surveyed 207 law enforcement agencies across the country, asking them if they had destroyed any rape kits since 2010. We asked them for very specific data, why they destroyed each kit, whether or not they had submitted the kits to a lab for testing, and we asked for case file numbers and various other points of data. And so 99 responded, so nearly half responded, saying that they had destroyed rape kits. And so we sought full investigative files tied to those rape kits. And our goal was to try to learn what were the investigative decisions in these cases that were being made that led to this evidence destruction. So we obtained and reviewed more than 1,400 rape investigations and determined that in at least 400 of those cases, the kits were destroyed before the statute of limitations expired on the crimes or when there was no time limit to prosecute. And we also discovered that at least 80% of the kits that we found destroyed before the statute of limitations were never tested.
Why did the law enforcement officials you spoke to say that they had destroyed these kits?
So departments defended this practice by saying we have to make space in the evidence room, and this is a routine part of policing. And some of these circumstances that we saw happening were when a prosecutor would decline to file charges, police would then assume a case wouldn't be moving forward, and so a rape kit would be destroyed anywhere from a few months to a year or 2 years after that determination was made. We also found this was very frequent. Victims were dubbed uncooperative when they would report their rape. They would go through the extremely invasive process of a rape exam, but at some point they would back away from law enforcement, and there can be a lot of reasons for that. Perhaps they're experiencing trauma. Perhaps, you know, going through a rape investigation is very, very challenging and can be extremely intimidating. So victims would back away and they would be, again, dismissed as uncooperative in the case files, and then their rape kits would be destroyed. But what's key to remember is that when a crime can still be prosecuted, it is absolutely essential to maintain that evidence.
So in some cases, the crimes had not yet been prosecuted. Arrests may have been made, but no evidence was presented at trial because these kits had been destroyed?
No, let me stress something. These are unsolved cases.
Uh-huh.
So these are cases where arrests have not been made. In many of the cases we reviewed, suspects had not even been identified. In other cases, they had been identified, but law enforcement officers did not even bother to pursue those suspects. We read dozens of cases in which witnesses were identified and police did not pursue those witnesses. We found many cases in which rape kits were destroyed following flawed and incomplete investigations. And you had Anne on earlier. She was one of the experts that graciously spent time helping us review scores of investigations to determine where there were mistakes made.
So these were destroyed after a certain amount of time to make room. Is there any legality or illegality, rather, in destroying evidence before a trial or before even an arrest?
This is one of the things that I found stunning in this experience of reporting this project, that there just are not laws that prohibit the destruction of rape kits in unsolved cases. Now, because you have seen a big lobby by the Innocence Project over, you know, the past decade, really, there have been laws passed prohibiting the destruction of evidence post-conviction. But when we're talking about, you know, it just made no sense to me or my team or the very seasoned experts that we consulted that there would not be laws prohibiting that.
I'm curious about what even spurred the investigation for you to look into destroyed rape kits in PDs.
Sure. So in 2015, I was asked to just cover a press conference. I was in the newsroom. And in North Carolina, the Fayetteville police chief got up, to the podium and said, "We regret to say that we have destroyed 333 rape kits," but there was really no explanation as to how that destruction occurred or why. So as soon as the press conference was over, I sent a public records request, which yielded an audit and did some digging and learned at that department that they were destroying rape kits really to make evidence, to make space in the evidence room. And again, the same situation where investigations were extremely poor. And I wanted to know, beyond Fayetteville, is this a problem throughout the country? And it turns out, as one of our experts said, this is a systemic problem nationally.
How about here in Georgia? Did you find any specifics here?
So we surveyed 3 to 5 agencies in every state, and we did not find rape kit destruction in the 3 agencies that we surveyed in Georgia, and that was Lake City, Hapeville, and Atlanta Police Department. But consider this. There are 17,000 law enforcement agencies in the country, and we only surveyed 207, and 99 said they destroyed. So taking that, there could certainly be rape kit destruction going on in Georgia. And I would love to see local reporting, you know, dig into that. Send a records request to your law enforcement agency.
How did police respond when asked about the destruction? You said that they thought it was routine, but what is their side of the story?
Sure. Again, there are at least 3 law enforcement agencies stopped destroying rape kits during our reporting. I think this stems from it's not nefarious, really. It stems from a lack of training, in understanding the value of maintaining DNA evidence, that it can solve not just the case that you're working on in front of you, but it can solve, if you're working on a rape case in Georgia, you might have a suspect that's involved in another rape in Michigan. And when you submit that rape kit for testing and DNA is uploaded to CODIS, the National DNA Database, you can make those connections. So it can solve so many crimes. So there was an ignorance about that. And there's also a pervasive ignorance that we found in the way that police understand trauma. So for example, if a victim doesn't call a detective back in 10 days or 2 weeks or a month, there seemed to be a belief that she was uncooperative, quote unquote, uncooperative, that she or he did not want their rape investigated. And avoidance and withdrawal are common symptoms of trauma. So there needs to be more training in trauma for law enforcement across the country.
So, Mark, I'm going to turn to you. Give us a snapshot of the findings from the collaboration that you worked on. This was between ProPublica, Newsy, and Reveal.
Well, what we did was sort of almost the next chapter of this is that, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about rape test kits around the country for some time now. And I think what we're bringing new to the conversation is that we surveyed more than 100 police departments across the country. And what we found out was that many of these departments, when they're having a hard time getting an investigation to move forward, will actually claim credit for a win as far as the public is concerned, and that they will clear the case and tell the public, hey, everybody, everything's sort of good here. We've solved the case. It's cleared. When you unpack it, however, in many departments, including some in Georgia, we found that they're turning to a very little-known designation that no one's been reporting on. Even academia has not studied this nationally. And this little-known designation is supposed to be used very rarely, very sparingly, but it makes it seem as if the case is solved when indeed what police are doing is leaving the alleged rapist on the streets when they have a probable cause to make an arrest. They're not doing it. They're not moving forward with prosecutions, and they're leaving someone on the streets to, in some cases, very sadly, we found, pray again.
And this designation, is this what you mean by exceptional clearance? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and it's really not been talked about before. So what this is, in order for police to do it, is they have to know where the suspect is. They have to know the name of the person. They have to have probable cause to make an arrest. If there's something that's really outside of their control, like the suspect is, let's say, dead. You can't really arrest a dead person. Or let's say they're in jail in North Korea and they're not going to be extradited. The FBI and the DOJ have set this designation up in order to not punish police agencies that have really done a good job in solving the crime, so that they can claim that they've solved the case as part of their clearance rates, which are how police are measured. How the public and city council and county commissioners look to police agencies to measure the cops and see how effective are they at their jobs, and so in those rare cases, you give them a bonus. But what we have found is in far too many cases that the quote unquote designation that should be the exception to the rule has actually become the rule, where some cop shops are clearing more cases by exceptional means than by making an arrest and taking these people off the streets. And the really hard thing here is we tracked an alleged child predator who was exceptionally cleared when police had a trove of evidence against him. They never even interview the guy, but they clear him. They look better to the public as if they've solved the case. But the guy went on, and he's now standing trial for allegedly having sex with another underage girl up in Wisconsin.
I wanted to pick up on that story when we come back from a break, but Ashley, you had something, and if you can make it quick.
Yeah, we saw that happening, too, in the cases that we looked at, the wrongful exceptional clearance. If you go to CNN.com/destroyed, you'll be able to dive into the rape files, which are investigations, and you can see exactly what Mark is talking about, that wrongful application of clearance.
Ashley Fonts there from CNN. She's a journalist who did investigations on destroyed rape kits, also speaking with Mark Greenblatt. He's with Newsy, and they both reported on mishandling sexual assault cases, and we're going to be back with more after a quick break. This is On Second Thought. Stay with us. From GBB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia's Bureau of Investigation has, after nearly 3 years, caught up on processing untested rape kits. Well, we were talking earlier about the reasons for that backlog, and now on to some other issues surrounding the handling of rape kits and cases. I'm speaking with Mark Greenblatt, investigative journalist with Newsy, who learned about police departments closing rape cases without solving them. And CNN journalist Ashley Fonts is also here. Her team learned that sometimes rape kits are destroyed when they are still needed as evidence. Mark, I want you to pick up on that case in Janesville, Wisconsin, which was detailed on Reveal, a program that we air here on GPB. This case is cleared series. What happened here?
Well, look, in this case, police in an agency called Howard County, Maryland, had collected a trove of evidence against an alleged child predator. He had, from Michigan, made online contact with a 12-year-old girl, and by the time she was 13, was driving down many hours to meet her, take her on a date to Wendy's, and then eventually to a place called the Homestyle Inn, where they engaged in sex, according to police records, and according to the girl's testimony to police. Well, the trouble is that the sex was taking place across county lines in neighboring Baltimore County. And so the detectives who had really earned the trust of the victim had to hand the case over to the neighboring detectives who were not able to win the same kind of trust. They made a couple of phone calls to the girl and her family, were not able to get cooperation after a couple of phone calls and a letter. And so they cleared the case, but they cleared it exceptionally. And this is this type of clearance that gives the Baltimore County Police a win, makes them look better to the public as if they've solved the case. But they left the guy on the streets. They didn't call the FBI. They didn't interview him. They didn't have the case reviewed by prosecutors. They simply left him on the streets. And then he went on and has now allegedly committed a similar crime in Wisconsin. And when he was found there, he was found with child porn on his phone that police believe also links perhaps another girl in Ohio to the same individual.
So this idea of police departments declaring cases cleared, how did you get below the numbers there, beyond those declarations that went out to the public?
Well, it's very hard because the FBI and the Department of Justice don't even know how many cases are exceptionally cleared for the majority of police agencies. All they ask in the Uniform Crime Report of the majority of police agencies right now is, you know, do you clear the crimes that you're reporting into the National Uniform Crime Report? What they don't ask is, do you clear them by arrest or by exceptional means? And so we had to go and really fight for these records very hard with all the agencies across the country that we reached out to unpack this. And many didn't want to give the information up, but we did it. We're actually suing. We're in active litigation with one major agency right now who still doesn't want to give this information up. So this is not easily accessible information. You have to fight for it. And sometimes even when you're in the right, you have to sue.
How many actual arrests then in these cases that were declared to be cleared?
Well, let's take, since we're in Georgia here today, Cobb County, Georgia is a good example. In 2016, they had 91 reports of rape, and we've published all this information for every major police agency in the country on ProPublica.org. People can go look up for all the big city agencies, the kinds of numbers I'm about to say. So 91 rape cases in Cobb County in 2016, 29 of those were reported as cleared cases. 29 of those were reported, 20, I apologize, 58 were were cleared, 29 cleared by arrest, 29 cleared by exceptional means. So this is a case where this agency is half the time that they claim to be making a clearance for the crime of rape. It's actually done in this way where they never make any arrest, never, there is no prosecution, and the person is left on the streets, despite the fact that the police have probable cause to make the arrest.
All right. So Ashley referred to the lack of training on the part of some police and government officials or law enforcement officials. She said the destruction was due to that. And we got a note on Twitter from Ann Gerber. I think it could also be a lack of compassion or empathy by police. Do you think that that's playing out here at all? There's a lack of understanding. Ashley, I'm going to put that to you first.
Yes. I mean, I think that it goes beyond training. There's one police department in Springfield, Missouri that we highlighted in which we found that at least one investigator on the day she would inherit a case would send a letter. And this was a department-sanctioned tool, by the way. It wasn't just this detective using this letter, but she was using it in this way. She would get the case and she would send a letter that's to the victim who had just gone through a rape exam, who had just detailed their sexual assault to a patrol officer. The letter said, "You have 10 business days to engage with me or your rape will not be investigated further." You know, you could say that that is about training, but to her point, that's true. You know, another thing I wanted to talk about that Mark made me think about, we saw, of course, the wrongful application of exceptional clearance. And there is a way for law enforcement to not do that. What rape investigations are incredibly complex, very challenging. You run into a lot of walls, leads run dry, maybe testing your evidence doesn't move a case forward. So I do want to underscore that they're tough investigations, they have an option. They can suspend or leave open an investigation. So that means a busy detective who's probably overloaded with too many cases can press pause and set an investigation aside, maintaining all of your evidence. So if something changes, new evidence emerges, your victim decides to reengage, you can move forward with an investigation. But we found that rape kits were being destroyed even in open investigations. Hmm. So completely nullifying the whole purpose of leaving a case open.
Is this just about too few? Go ahead, Mark. You want to pick that up?
Well, I this is a perfect segue because we studied Austin Police Department in Texas quite closely, and talking about suspended cases as an option. Well, in Austin, you know, showing that this is not just about a training issue. In some cases, police in what we were investigating are actually intentionally, apparently, really misleading the public here, which really raises the stakes. We got in touch with a 26-year veteran of the Austin Police Department, Sergeant Liz Donegan, who used to lead the sex crimes unit. And what she told us for the first time anywhere is that she was approached by her commander through two lieutenants that are her bosses and ordered to change the clearance codes from the status of suspended, which is this dormant status if they just haven't been able to make progress in the rape investigation, to actually exceptionally clear the case, which gives them public credit for looking good. She felt it was unethical, wrong, and she refused the order and eventually was transferred out of the unit. This is not always the case where at least the public relations side of how the cops are doing in investigating these cases is entirely innocent or just a lack of training. But at least in some cases, there does appear to be an intentional effort to mislead the public.
All right. Just quickly, if you could talk about, Ashley, what kind of reforms do you think we still need to make when it comes to how law enforcement handles sexual assault cases?
So there's a way to actually improve this and improve it, I think, pretty quickly. And that's that law enforcement agencies should audit their sex crimes investigations, and they should mimic what is known in law enforcement best practice as the Philadelphia model. In 1999, the Philadelphia Inquirer ran an expose showing that the Philly police had mishandled rape investigations for many years. And so you can imagine there was widespread public outrage. And the Philadelphia Philadelphia Women's Law Project, which is a consortium of attorneys, then began in 2000 and still to this day annually sits side by side with detectives, and they review investigations to make sure that they're conducted in a trauma-informed and thorough manner. And that is, as one expert told me, the essence of community policing. And you show the public that you're being transparent. You have outside people come in, and it isn't a finger-wagging exercise or cross-examination, but that's exactly what agencies should be doing.
Ashley Funds, she is an investigative journalist at CNN. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Mark Greenblatt, he's an investigative journalist with Newsy, who learned about police departments closing rape cases, declaring them cleared without solving them. Mark, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
Looking to diversify your reading list? Well, look no further. Anthony Grooms is an author and creative writing professor at Kennesaw State University. He stopped by with recommendations for our Southern Reading List series on books that define and reflect the South.
Hello, my name is Tony Grooms, also known as Anthony Grooms, and here's my Southern reading list. One of the problems with doing a project like this is trying to decide which few books to talk about, because there are so many that I like. But I've selected these books primarily because they deal with a subject that I'm really interested in. As a novelist, I write primarily about African-American history of the 20th century. My novel, The Vain Conversation, published this year, follows the witness of a lynching in Georgia from just after World War II to the 1970s, for example. So these books that I've chosen, I've selected because they are primarily Southern writers. They deal with African-American subject matter. And the first one I want to talk about is Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America by Patrick Phillips. Back in 1987, my wife and I and a friend found ourselves on a crowded bus leaving downtown Atlanta and headed up to Forsyth County, Georgia, where we were participating in a silent march, part of the Brotherhood March in Forsyth County. This was an interesting experience for us because we saw at the periphery of the march Klansmen, some of them hooded, some of them not, with guns, and luckily for us too, also state patrol there to protect us. But a profound experience. Later, Oprah brought her show to Forsyth County, and she had too a somewhat scary experience.
We bring you today to Forsyth County, Georgia, just 30 miles north of Atlanta, which in the past few weeks has gained the reputation of being a hotbed of racism.
So I've been interested in Forsyth County from that perspective. And here, Patrick Phillips, who at the time that my wife and I were marching there, was also marching there as a teenager who lived in the county. He had liberal parents who had actually participated in the very first Brotherhood March, which was about a week before the one in which Hosea Williams, the civil rights leader, was stoned. This book really delved into the history of it. It's a beautifully written book, and it's a book that emphasizes the relationship between history and the present. It really explores the legacy of what happens when people are deprived of their properties, for example, and other people essentially steal it from them. 50 years, 60, 70 years later, that property becomes very valuable. So those people who were purged, as it goes, then have lost out and other people have benefited. Another book I'd like to talk about is a novel. It's a bit of a quirky novel, and it's called Halo by Grace Stewart. This is a satirical novel, and it's told in a highly ironic voice, a voice, in fact, that I think most major corporate presses, I call it Holly York presses, those corporate presses based in New York. The tone of the voice is very ironic. It takes a little bit of getting used to, but once you get that tone, the book is not only hilarious, but it drives to some very important social criticism, some critique of Southern manners, and particularly a critique of race relations in Atlanta. The final book I'd like to talk about is called A Lesson Before Dying. I work as a judge for the Ernest Gaines Foundation, the Ernest Gaines Literary Award. The novel has a fairly simple premise. It involves a premise of trying to teach a man about his own dignity. The story begins when a young black man, Jefferson, is a passive participant in a murder of a prominent white store owner in 1940s Louisiana. And I say passive participant, Jefferson doesn't seem to be wholly aware of the consequences of his being on the premise when two other boys murder the storekeeper. Nonetheless, he's convicted. As a part of his defense, however, his defense attorney tells the jury that he shouldn't be convicted because he doesn't have a mind of his own. He's not a man. In fact, he is a hog. So this is the setup. Is Jefferson a hog? The protagonist is Grant Wiggins, who's a school teacher in the area. He's been away from the area out west, much as Ernest Gaines was. He left Louisiana for a while and was educated in California, but maintained a strong relationship with Louisiana. Grant Wiggins comes back to Louisiana, and his Aunt Lou tells him that he has to go to the jail and teach Jefferson how to be a man. And of course, this is a task he doesn't want to take on, and it's a task that he feels is impossible. I like the book also because in a very subtle way, it explores the social oppression of black people. When you look at that school that is described in the novel, for example, and you see what those poor children have to go through, how what they lack in terms of resources, and how the parents and the teacher struggles to give them those resources. So that's kind of my take on a couple of my favorite books at the moment. I should end by saying I have a lot of favorite books, and I would love to talk more about what they are.
That was Kennesaw State creative writing professor Anthony Grooms. His latest novel, The Vain Conversation, focuses on the question of redemption from racial crimes. If you have suggestions for our Southern reading list, let us know in our Facebook group, GPB Radio's On Second Thought.